Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. According to what I've just been told, here's the podcast for the Early Morning Late Show. Enjoy our conversations. Good morning. So glad you're with me today. It is Wednesday. It is May 23. So glad you're starting your day with Faith Radio and the Early Morning Late Show. I just love it. I love it, love it, love it. All right, here's a passage out of Romans 15:2, which I was looking at this morning. Each of us should please our neighbors for their good, to build them up. Talk about love our neighbors, but what about build them up? When was the last time we actually took the time to build them up, compliment them, encourage them, try to carry their burden a little bit, if possible, maybe shovel a walk or cut a lawn or do something that just would be extra helpful that might build them up. Sometimes we can be so busy that we don't notice things going on just right around us. It's right in front of our face, and we miss it. So let's pay attention to that stuff. And I also want to say reality is a helper. Be nice to it. It's what you got. All right. Billy Graham said his final will and testament is now public. The estate. It's in the famed evangelical. In it, he praised his wife Ruth and called on his family to uphold the gospel at all costs. Graham asked his family to lead a life of separation from the world, keeping eternal values in sight. He called on them to read the Bible daily. Trusting is the salvation provided by the blood of Jesus. All right, we've got a great show this morning. Very interesting conversation coming up in just a minute or two with Al Parada. He is the managing editor of The Stream. And we're going to talk about the set the record straight on the history of American immigration and uncover the principles with which our forefathers migrated to America. So that's going to be up next. It's 6 minutes after the hour. Stay tuned. When we come back, Al Parada is with us.
Hi, I'm Ted Ross with the Faith in Life Minute. Scott and Bethany Palmer are known as the money couple, and Scott says when you get into a relationship, you can't expect the other person to suddenly change their money habits.
What you're doing is you're basically saying, this was fine when it was working for me when we were dating, but now that we're married, this isn't going to work. And what we find is that people will give up. People will get to the point where they just can't take anymore. People will get to the point where they say, I just don't want to deal with this person anymore, especially when it comes to money, and they either get divorced or they live separate money lives, and they start living separate money lives, and secret credit cards start creeping in, and separate accounts start creeping in, and all of these things start happening, which make the relationship even worse. And so that judgment and that nitpicking, you have to get to a point where you really have the ability to reflect and say, okay, how are we different? What are the pros and the cons? And then how do we move forward as a couple?
Learn more from Scott and Bethany Palmer at myfaithradio.com.
Minutes after the hour, I saw that in 1953, Cliff Notes were first used in schools. I think that's all I used in schools. Cliff Notes. Yeah, I was not a great student, but I did took a class in high school called Novels Before College, and we had to read Gone with the Wind. And I think I went and saw the movie the night before the test. Not proud of that either. All right, let's talk about immigration. We've got Al Parada on the line, and he is an author and a new guest to the program. Al, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Thank you for getting up early. Do you live on the West Coast?
No, we live in Dallas area.
Oh, awesome. So it's not super, it's early, but not super early.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Yes. Well, no, it was either me or like I said, my co-author, John Zemirak, who's a late-night person, and there would have been trouble if he was on at this time of the hour. There would have been FCC, would have been all over everybody. It would have been trouble.
So. I love it.
I took one for the team today.
Oh, how nice of you. And
I'm honored.
Yeah.
Truly.
And tell us the name of your book again.
Okay, it is called The Politically Incorrect Guide to Immigration.
I love it.
An America First Manifesto. from Regnery.
Yeah, I love it. Why do we need a politically incorrect guide?
Well, basically because we have a mess. We have an immigration mess in this country, and we need to say what needs to be said. And so it's politically incorrect in that way, and we're saying some things that some people might not like or right now. Now, the real title of the book would have been, this wasn't politically incorrect when Democrats said it a couple of years ago, but now that we're saying it, it's now called Politically Incorrect Guide to Immigration. But that couldn't fit on the cover.
Exactly. Okay. We tried. Yeah. Let's talk about some of the facts about immigration that we should know that maybe we don't.
Well, one thing we should talk about is the cost. And we're talking about illegal immigration costs us about $116 billion with a B,
yeah,
dollars a year. Yeah, they talk about illegal immigrants contributing to – yeah, but that's about $19 billion. The cost is around $135. You do the math, it's about
$116.
I know. I stopped doing it, something happened to my brain.
Seriously, yes, when is the last time you used algebra?
So I hear there are people who do math, and what they tell me is it's 116. But think of it another way: is we spend about $44 billion on educating illegal immigrants, and $44 billion, if you look into it, is that's about 1,600 new schools you can build or hire, 750,000 new teachers. Just to put it in, in a perspective we can understand.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking that could get you 750,000 new teachers in a year.
Wow.
It's basically averaging out a salary sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It's a rough number, but basically that gives you some picture. So we're spending a lot of money. Now, the other part of it is because we've had such an influx of illegal immigrants over the past generation and legal, that's put a horrible pressure on wages in this country for a generation, a couple generations now. And so that is one of the issues we really have to deal with, is what is it doing to our economy? That's one reason we need to solve the problem. Also, you simply cannot have 20 million people running around in a country illegally. You just can't do it. Like Reagan was saying, a country without borders is no country, basically. And also, again, Democrats said the same thing. Barbara Jordan in the 90s was saying the exact same thing, a Democrat from Texas. No country worth its salt is worth its salt unless it has a border, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I'm paraphrasing her. But the same idea. We kind of understood that we needed to do this. And, of course, security is a huge issue too. So huge issue, especially with my background. I used to work for a counterterrorism guy, and that scared the you-know-what out of me.
Oh, yeah.
Knowing how susceptible we are. And when it comes down to it, I'd rather pay a few more pennies for lettuce than watch San Diego get hit with a dirty bomb.
Yeah, good point.
That's sort of people – I don't think – if people really grasp the danger that there is, there'd be a lot more emphasis on it. But, of course, the American people are with us and wanting to have more security and having a wall and this, that, and the other thing. So
yeah,
there you go. And we lay it out in the book, and we go back into the history and really say how we got into this mess, who got us into this mess, who wants to keep us in this mess, but more importantly, how we get out of this mess for the next generation of people who want to be great Americans,
yeah,
who want to come to this country and buy into the whole thing and grab hold of that American dream.
Yeah. Al, here's what I hear all the time. But we're a nation of immigrants. So what does that mean? What did the founders of our country have in mind? What did they believe, and how did that shape the country?
Well, first off, that makes no sense. We're a nation of assimilation. Okay, we're also
a nation of assimilation. I like that.
Assimilation. Yeah. We're all. But think of it this way: we weren't just a nation of immigrants. We were a nation of settlers who had an idea about being away, not having a government controlling their lives.
Mm.
There were immigrants. And, slaves and Native Americans. So a bunch of things. To me, when I hear the phrase nation of immigrants, I'm hearing we're a nation of separate interest groups. But the assimilation idea is great. Now, going back to our founders, they understood that as a growing country with a lot of elbow room, we were going to need folks. But they wanted people – they're pretty much unanimous that they wanted people who bought into the idea of – that limited, basically limited government, that idea that they would be in control of their lives. They'd be hardworking people who weren't looking at a top-down thing, but looking from the bottom up, from their own sweat, their household, their community, and going from the ground up. Those mm-hmm. kind of folks. That's what they were looking for. Now, here's, when we talk about founders, the one that fascinated me, the more research I did, was Alexander Hamilton. I mean, this is a guy who's got his own musical, so we got to pay attention to him.
Right? Yeah, absolutely.
Especially
at those ticket prices.
Especially at those ticket prices, yeah. Whoa, okay. But here's something he said. He didn't like the idea of putting people into the country. This guy was an immigrant. Alexander Hamilton was an immigrant, but he didn't like the idea of immigrants who didn't fit with what was the intent of the nation. He thought it was poisonous. But he gave us a phrase that should have been a song. I don't know if it is a song. It should be a song. And I love it. I love it. It's called – he said – he's looking at a harmony of ingredients. And to me, when we talk about melting pot, America as a melting pot, you can throw anything into a pot, but it could kill you. The poison, you have something poisonous come out of it.
Right.
No, but the harmony of ingredients is a much more beautiful image, because you are talking harmony. Harmony involves different things. It involves diversity, but the diversity working together for a good and music. Obviously, it's a good sound to have harmony.
Mm-hmm.
Different melodies coming together to create a beautiful sound, and that harmony of ingredients is something we look forward to, and so, although of course when you write a book called Politically Incorrect Guide to Immigration, people are going to call you xenophobic no matter what you have in the book. You can have a blank book and they'd still call you xenophobic.
Yeah, good point.
But that's not where we're coming from. We're coming for that idea of getting the ingredients that mix well for what we want America to be.
Yeah. Al, let me take a break. When I come back, I know that a lot of people think something's got to be done about the immigration issue, and I want to find out what you think should be done. It's 16 minutes after the hour. Al Parada is my guest. I'll be right back. It's 19 minutes after the hour. Al Parada is my guest. He's written a book called The Politically Incorrect Guide to Immigration, not available in Cliff Notes yet, but I'm looking forward to that version as well. Al, so there's so many people say that something must be done about illegal immigration, but we are certainly disagreeing as a country on how to and what to do and how to do it. What is your approach in the book?
Well, our approach is really practical. We lay out 15 steps. We call it Mission America, and it. Among the items in that are the logical ones that the most people kind of agree with. You got to build the wall. You've got to have security. You've got to track those people who come into the country on visas and stay. That's a big problem. We tend to visualize the folks sneaking over the fence kind of thing. But you got people who come in here on visas and stay. And we're talking about like 750,000 people a couple years ago. That's
mm-hmm.
a lot of – that's 7 Rose Bowls, okay?
Yeah, a lot of folks.
So we don't pay attention as much to that problem, but that's a real problem. We have to track those people, make sure they leave when they're supposed to leave. We also stripping sanctuary cities of federal funding. We don't want to cause incentives. Anything we can do to to de-incentivize, we want to do. E-verify, simple, it works. You just check, can this person work here? Are they allowed to work in this country? Yes or no? Boom. It's an easy question. It's an easy thing, and the technology works, but it's not mandatory. We need to have that wherever. We need to have that in every business with over 5 people. You also have stopping chain migration. Again, this is one of those things that people don't think about so much. Somebody who becomes a naturalized citizen can now bring over other folks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and it gets really extended, and that becomes an exponential thing. For example, something like 7.8 million people. Again, we're talking numbers. I know neither of us likes the numbers, but hey, 7.8 million people in 10 years came in under chain migration. Now, it's one thing to bring in your, a close relative, a parent, a child, a close sibling, but this chain migration allows, farther out there, the cousins, the person who drove with. Who drove with your aunt and uncle in an Uber? That person's allowed to come in.
Right, the cousin you've never met is coming in.
Yeah, people never met. You can't do it. And again, what do they have? Are those people bringing something that America needs, or are they here because they just happen to be related to somebody. What's better for America?
It's to have people who fill a need.
Basically, yeah. That's one of the questions, one of the mindsets that we need to get a wrap our heads around. And for some reason, a lot of people don't get like this. But what works best for America, and Americans?
Yeah.
You know, that's, again, I'm a simple guy. I co-wrote the book with John Zemerick. If you've never met John Zemerick, he's a very deep thinker and all this. I'm not as deep as him, you know
yeah.
what I'm saying? I think more simply. It's like, you know, if Alabama's football team can pick the players it wants on its team, why can't America? You know, that's sort of the way I look at it.
Yeah.
You know, we're America. You know, there's like, 150 million people around the world or so who want to be Americans. Well, we get to be a little selective. Why
yeah.
not?
Well, Al, you said something about being a country of assimilation. I think that's something yes. that we need to be reminding ourselves of. But yet many, many faithful Christians and followers of Christ, they disagree about immigration because they simply just want to help people, help those who are in need and not split up families.
Yeah, yes, and that's the rub. But is that the government's job? Church, you know what I mean? It's like, what is the government policy going to be?
Yeah.
As a believer, we do want to help people. But again, let's flip it around. How Christian is it to allow, knowing that 80% of the girls and females who come up from Central America get molested or raped along the way? If we're creating an incentive to come to this country by having open borders, are we not party to those assaults?
Mm-hmm.
So there's other ways to look at it too from a faith perspective. It's like, what are we doing for the betterment of all? And one thing I when we wrestle with this is something I really had to wrestle with, is the notion of, okay, what is going to work better for the person who wants to be an American if later, you know, coming in the next generation? And so that's what where my heart looks at it. We have to create a system so that person who's coming has a path to success and prosperity. Again, you can look at it from a Christian point of view. The way the system is set up now, it almost depresses the people who come here,
mm-hmm.
illegally or illegally, because so many are coming in. You can't assimilate them, which assimilation is, of course, the best way forward for success. So, how Christian is it to allow a system that suppresses people, because it won't let them move forward in prosperity?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a different way. But again, you do have to care for people. You know, we don't want to leave people in the streets. And again, you think of like in Los Angeles, for example. Yeah, there's a history of helping people. Like before social welfare programs and the Depression, who was saving people on the streets of Los Angeles? It was Amy Semple McPherson and her ministry. She's mm-hmm. the one who's feeding half the illegal immigrants in L.A. and keeping them alive. So there's a role to play, the church, in caring, but it's also in thinking of the big picture. We have to be responsible for the big picture.
Yeah. Al, just got about a minute left. The Bible, does it speak to this issue?
Oh, you can argue that several different ways.
Mm-hmm.
They talk about caring for the stranger,
yep.
but there's also the argument that the word used there is not the word that is usually used for foreigner. It's a word that applies to people who are from different places but are given, that have been granted a right, and so there is an element of legality involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where that's one thing that the Bible does talk about. But it also an argument can be made that our policy needs to be based on natural law. We don't, in a sense, our government doesn't want to be forcing a religious answer. However, there's a Christian ethic that is involved. And again, that's what this country was founded on. It was founded on this notion of that the individual, you know, has life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I know I'm talking cliches here a little bit, but that's where we came from, this idea that there's a value to each person. And so in our book, one thing we do talk about a lot is the recognition that the immigrant is not a commodity, like some people say, you know, hey, they're just going to buy stuff. That's good.
Right.
You know, not just a, or voter, a future voter. You know what I'm saying? It's like there's inherent dignity. And so what works best to give that person dignity when they do come here and a future, the dignity in the future? What can we do to make that happen? Are we teaching people? Are our social programs in churches, are we teaching them how to assimilate, or are we teaching them how to get government programs that will keep them enslaved to those government programs? Tell me which one is the more, quote, Christian way to go.
Right, right.
Moving forward or a way towards suppression. So
yeah,
it's a debate, and it's a debate we have to have as people of faith of what works best for us. And
yeah,
a
very emotional debate, too.
Yes.
Every time we have this topic on the show, we get a lot of feedback.
Yeah. It's a fascinating thing, but it can be done, and that's another point in the book. There are solutions, and we can do this.
Yeah, I will forward you the emails, Al.
Oh, okay. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on the show. Thanks for writing the book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Immigration. Al Parada has been my guest. Thank you so much, Al. Look forward to another conversation.
Have a great day, and bless everybody out there.
Thank you so much. 27 minutes after the hour, we'll take a break and be right back. Good morning. It's 31 minutes after the hour. Kent Kaiser is already in studio, which makes me happy. But we're going to take a break for news, and then we'll be back with Dr. Kent Kaiser in just a minute.
If you're a mom, don't miss an opportunity that is so uniquely yours in shaping the lives of your children. This is Jim Garlow in a special series for the family. In the 18th century, John Wesley's explosive evangelistic renewal spread all over the world. But it was his mother, Susanna Wesley, who helped shape this man into who he became. She was the 25th child of 25 children herself, and she birthed 19 children. Yet she kept meticulous notes on each child and had daily prayer written out for each one. There was strict discipline in their home with theological discussions, readings from Scripture, prayer, and study. Her training up of her children was deliberate and intentional to build into them biblical values that would last a lifetime. The emphasis isn't on strict, it's on deliberate and intentional. It's what being godly parents is all about. There's more at jimgarlow.com.
Until the top of the hour, I'm delighted to have Dr. Kent Kaiser in studio. And he is sitting across the studio table from me and just freshly got through the school, another school year. Congratulations, Kent.
Thanks.
Yeah. So now summer is started for you, right?
Yeah, I just got off of a canoe trip, actually.
I can see because you're sporting this tan. I'm going, this is really a nice tan for
it's
May.
It's a real farmer's tan.
Yeah, no, but seriously, I'd have to live in Tahiti for 15 years to get that tan. And I'd like to, actually. But anyway, let's get to some of the order of business today. Starbucks is now trying to clarify its new policy. And they're trying to – I'd be nervous if I were them.
Yeah, Starbucks came under heat because they tried to shoo some people out of the store where they weren't customers. I mean, they were just coming in to occupy the space and stay warm or whatever and find shelter. And – It is interesting. Now they've kind of said that they're okay with people being in their stores as long as they're not on drugs or as long as they're not sleeping. Mm-hmm. Because what they're really – well, it's interesting to see what happens. You know, these public spaces, you know, they're available to people who are customers and they have bathrooms and so on. You can imagine then they become attractive to homeless people. And I think it's an interesting story because – I don't know. In many cities, it's almost like a. I don't want to say it's a joke, but it's sort of an unwritten understanding that the public libraries serve this function. I'm not even kidding.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember one time there was a candidate who was running for the mayor of St. Paul, Minnesota, who, when you asked him, "Well, what are you going to do that's different from the previous mayor?" "Oh, I'm going to keep the libraries open longer." Like. And the reason, I mean, you know, he didn't even have to state why. People understood that was in order to provide, like, daytime homeless shelter capacity for the city, because, you know, there are nighttime homeless shelters, but they usually don't open until something like 10 or 11 p.m. and they shoo people out of there at 6 or 7 in the morning. And so then where do the homeless people go during the day? Well, oftentimes it's to the libraries. So it's interesting to see in this case that it's a private business. And I suppose, you know, like a lot of private businesses must be up against this, because, I mean, where, if you're a homeless person, where do you have to go? I mean, it's unfortunate. This is our solution to homelessness, is to either put pressure on these private businesses to be open or to have our public libraries open more. Mm-hmm. I mean, that doesn't seem like a solution at all, but it's kind of a place where homeless people are warehoused, or whatever you want to say. And that's what's kind of going on here. So if I don't know if people kind of understand the kind of the undercurrent of what policy there is here, but it is our policy for homeless people just to shift them back and forth between the homeless shelters and now places like Starbucks and other public businesses that have bathrooms available and that, and so, or to the public libraries. Now, the public libraries have very few restrictions. I mean, nobody's going to say, no, you can't sleep in the public library. No, they're not going to shoot people out of a public library, mm-hmm. right? I mean, in fact, the more people who show up there, the more they legitimize the, you know, hours that they're open and so on. But Starbucks, is being a private business, faces something different, which is, okay, we've got this paying clientele that's coming in there that might be find this off-putting if people are on drugs or sleeping in our restaurants. And so that, I think that's all kind of what's going on here.
Mm-hmm. All right, so the public relations firm of Kaiser, Kaiser, and Kaiser has been hired by Starbucks to handle the situation. What would they do?
Well, the bathroom situation is interesting. You know, in Minnesota, we actually have a law where if you are a business that has a bathroom, even if it's one that's just for employees, if somebody comes in there and says they have a bathroom emergency, you have to let them use it.
But that's with a doctor's note.
Well, but I think
if you've got a doctor that says this person needs to use a bathroom quickly,
right.
that they then have to honor that. But who runs around with a note from their doctor?
Well, right, exactly. And then most of the time, businesses are going to let somebody in anyway. But no, I think that if I were like with a PR firm or whatever for Starbucks or any of these businesses, I guess I would say that what they've done here, they're saying no drug use, no sleeping. I mean, I think that's a step in the right direction, because you always have to think about, okay, we actually have some customers. Okay. Now, another thing, you don't want them to be off put.
You mean the people that support your business?
Exactly. Well, you don't want them to be off put. Now, the other thing that they might do, honestly, is to do something like advocating for more help for homeless people. I mean, they might advocate for more shelter space or shelters to be open longer, or maybe even for more public library time, mm-hmm. or whatever you want to say. The Starbucks could come across in a positive light by actually addressing the underlying issue rather than targeting the specific people for, you know, whatever, shooing them out of the stores or allowing them to stay based on whether they're on drugs or not.
Another thing that they said, that you will be asked to leave if you improperly use the bathroom. How do you know if it's being improperly used? Isn't that a room you go into and close and lock a door?
I assume that they're talking about if people are going in there and trying to actually shower, clean up. That's my assumption. Rather than just go in and use the bathroom. We see that here at the school once in a while. We see that here at Northwestern.
See,
sometimes
what?
A homeless person will come into the bathroom downstairs and clean up, wash up. And so what they're doing is they're shaving, they're basically doing what you and I would do in the shower in the morning, mm-hmm. but in the sink. And so they leave a huge mess.
Okay.
And I mean, we see this, it's not uncommon, actually. I mean, I don't want to advocate that people come here and, you know, clean up in the morning. But
probably
honestly,
idea,
homeless people can get into our building. Homeless people can get into our building pretty easily and sometimes do. And that's, I think, probably what they're meaning by using the bathroom improperly.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think they've got a challenging issue on their hands. It's not going away. It's going to continue to be something that will be a topic of conversation when you see people sleeping at a Starbucks, and I look and I see there's no cup nearby. In other words, they have not purchased anything. Are you going to feel comfortable having a business meeting sitting next to them if that's the only table?
Right. No, and it's again, we need to get to the underlying issue of homelessness. And I mean, here's another one. I mean, you can read about this in different cities. They actually have this is an actual policy where cities will buy a one-way ticket, one-way bus ticket for people, for homeless people, to send them off to another city. Mm-hmm. San Diego has famously done this and sent people off to Arizona, off to like Tempe, Arizona, and stuff. And in Washington State, there's mm-hmm. cities that have actually bought one-way bus tickets to send people off to other locations. Oftentimes, the premise is that, oh, we're going to give you a one-way bus ticket to a city where you have a relative who ostensibly would be able to care for you, but that's not what happens. Of mm-hmm. course, the person shows up in the city and nobody wants to have anything to do with them, so then they would just wind up being a homeless person in a different city. Mm-hmm. That's not a good policy either, but it's like it's one of those superficial things. Like, oh, if we just get rid of the homeless people out of our city, we don't see them anymore. Then, like, if they it's out of sight, out of mind, or whatever you want to say, mm-hmm. and that's not a true policy for dealing with homelessness.
Well, it's so complicated because there's drug addiction in there, right. There's mental illness in there, and I work with men in recovery from addictions, and I've known people who have lived as homeless for a couple of years.
Right.
And because they wanted to continue, they're using their drugs, and so
right.
They're okay to sleep wherever and use whatever facilities they can wherever they can.
Right.
So it's a very complicated issue, but I would love to see people who are out of their homes and homeless find a way to thrive in life again, to have people from the Christian community come around and try to speak the truth into their life, help them get established once again, get a place to live, get a job, and that's when you start to feel good about life.
See, and that's where, like I say, if I were advising someplace like Starbucks, I would advise them to get behind something like that, to get behind a program that's actually going to help homeless people recover.
Yeah, but mm-hmm. that might also show some kind of specific value, which
yeah, exactly.
would get into the realm yeah. of, is that a Christian principle you're...
Or is it a Christian organization that you're helping because they've been effective right. in the past?
Yes, yeah, right? Exactly. All right, Kent, President Trump made a comment about the MS-13 gang, and he talked about them being animals, and I've read descriptions of their behavior and the way they have tortured, raped, and killed people. So when we come back, I want to ask you about his remark about them being animals, and should he have said that,
and the media reaction.
And the media reaction, and why the left in particular is very offended by that. It's 14 minutes till the top of the hour. When I come back, more with Dr. Ken Kaiser in just a minute. Minutes until the top of the hour. Romans 15:2 says, each of us should please our neighbors for their good to build them up. So as we talk about homelessness, we've got a big issue on our hands. And for Christians, we have to figure out a way to love the immigrant and love our neighbors and love everyone. Right, Kent?
Right. And when I read that verse, though, I think of it even more like, there's certain people you meet in life who actually are really good at this building other people up, not just helping out and stuff like that, but actually proactively speaking positively about yeah. somebody and finding their talent. I've always admired people who could look at someone and assess, oh, here's where their strengths lie, and channel those into something that makes them successful. I mean, I've been fortunate to have a few people in my life who are those kind of people who they build people up. They're really good at identifying what gifts people have. Mm-hmm. And then suggesting them for new jobs or new adventures or whatever, and I admire that. And that's yeah. how I kind of read the verse.
Now, the extremely violent MS-13 gang was recently described by President Trump as animals, and that got all kinds of attention from the media.
Well, there's hardly anybody who would probably disagree with the comment if you read it all in context or if you heard it all in context. I mean, the MS-13 gang members commit some of the most heinous crimes, and when they get deported, they somehow find their way back to the United States, and they get deported again and again and again, and that's what President Trump was commenting about. Unfortunately, the mainstream liberal media really did a disservice to their own profession, I think, by talking, by suggesting that the president was talking about immigrants in general. And they got called out, and they all had to do retractions and clarifications and corrections and so on. Unfortunately, you know, this is another case where they put out some bad information. I'm sure there's people out there who now believe that the president referred to all immigrants as animals, but he didn't. In fact, he was referring very specifically to these this criminal element, this horrible criminal element that, you know, I don't think, I don't understand, I don't think anybody could suggest that they are normal humans or that they don't deserve to be called animals. And yet, there are some people on the left who are trying to suggest that no one should be called an animal or nobody should be called something other than human because I don't get their way of thinking. That their way of thinking is that no act is so horrible that the person committing it shouldn't be called, you know, an animal, whatever.
It's a tough one. Dennis Prager weighed in and had some good commentary on it. And it's an article I enjoyed looking at. He said, anyone who refuses to dehumanize the Nazi physicians is profoundly morally confused.
Right. I think it's kind of I loved his commentary because I think, you know, a lot of liberals want to throw out these sorts of, you know, platitudes about, oh, we're all humans and we're all people and everybody's life is just as valid as everybody else's and, you know, all this junk. And you know, they don't think beyond the specific case. And I don't understand how they can look at MS-13 gang members and say these people deserve the dignity of being called human after all the things that they have done. But I love that Prager brings up the Nazis because I think even liberals would have to agree that many of the things that the Nazis did were not humane or not of humans and were, in fact, beastly, which is the word he says. Should we get rid of the word beastly too? Well, no, of course not. Some acts specifically are beastly, and therefore the people doing them are beasts, and beasts are animals. And so, I really enjoyed his commentary on it because he really takes to task the liberals who just do throw out these sort of platitudes without any justification.
Well, if you read some of the activity that this gang has done, I can't even repeat it on the air.
I know. It's so just heinous. Horrible, and it's like it's not appropriate for morning radio for sure. And you just kind of have to conjure up what's the worst kinds of things that you could ever think of appearing on a crime drama at night. And those are – and then take that and multiply it, and that's the kinds of things that MS-13 – gang members have done in the United States. And again, they're not from here. They're not citizens. They sneak across the border to commit their crimes. And I don't really understand, like, why? I mean, I don't think anybody could ever understand exactly why people do these really horrible crimes. I don't know what they're getting from it. It seems to be that it's just sort of like their little club to get together and show they have some power and commit these crimes in the United States. And, like, I think that must be just their goal in and of itself, which is just so warped. I mean, most of us can't even think this way. And again, they get sent home back to whichever countries they come from. Usually it's Mexico or someplace south of the border. And then they make their way back. And again, it just seems to be the goal in their life is to show that they have this power by being able to commit the more heinous crime. And it seems to be sort of a one-upsmanship among the MS-13 gang members to say, oh, yeah, you did this. Well, look at me. I did that. You know, and it's just the most, I don't even know, what warped kind of goal in life.
Yeah. Well, you know, they seem to want to value the criminal. They don't want to judge their evil actions, But what about devaluing the victims as well?
Well, there's that, and just like when, you know, it's like they don't want to put any morality on anything. And so what's a good act? You know, you got to look at it and say, like, well, then what would they consider to be something good or ennobling or uplifting? Mm-hmm. You know, if everything is equal and you don't want to say that anything is bad, then what's good? You know, it's that old argument about there is no good or bad. It's this moral relativism that just says, like, everybody's activities are just as valid as everybody else's. Well, no, we know that's not true.
And, Ken, doesn't it seem like ISIS is trying to find out what is the most barbaric way to kill somebody?
Well,
where you put them in cages and light them on fire?
Well, see, this is a question I kind of have, too. It's like, will the liberals say that that members of ISIS who are doing these things, would they say that they're evil? I think they'd probably not. I think they'd probably say, oh, these people are just, you know, they're just, this is what they do, and we don't want to judge, and they're good people, too. No, they're not, you know? And yeah, I don't understand that way of thinking.
Yeah, well, I agree. mean, we could go down this rabbit hole for a while, Kent.
Oh, I know.
I'm not so sure we should.
But yeah, I don't understand the liberal way of thinking of this, you know, moral relativity and stuff. I guess it's, you know, if you don't want to judge anybody. Because I think that what it comes down to is they don't really have a basis by which to judge anyone. If you throw out the Bible and you have no basis to say something's good or bad, then I suppose, you know, in that kind of a very neutral philosophy that, you know, everything that comes at you, it's just something different. Nothing's good or bad.
Yeah. Ken, thanks so much for coming in. I'll look forward to seeing you next week.
Thanks for having me on.
Yep, 3 minutes till the top of the hour. We'll take a short break and wrap up our Who Know. Thank you to Kent Kaiser and Al Parada. Hour one was awesome. Hour two coming up just in a few minutes. We're going to start with Bill English. And if you are a college senior walking across to get your diploma, you're looking at a job prospect up next. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.